you all so much for coming. My name is Paulina Pavoja. I'm a curatorial assistant in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, and I worked on the exhibition Gabriel Orozco, which is on view on the sixth floor galleries. It's organized by Ann Temkin, the chief curator of our department, and we had a lot of input from the artist. In fact, that's probably a bit of an understatement. I mean, Gabrielle was involved in every aspect of the exhibition, from the production of the catalog to coming up with a list of objects that we wanted to show, and very much to the way that they were actually installed in the galleries. And so what I hope to do today is give you a virtual tour of the exhibition, but because of the kind of beauty or genius of PowerPoint, I'll be able to pull in slides of objects that maybe aren't on view that will hopefully help contextualize his work and his practice. But to give you a quick introduction, biographical introduction, Gabriel is 47 years old. He was born in 1962 in Jalapa, Mexico. He studied art in Mexico City and then spent a year in Madrid and moved to New York in the early 90s. So what we're going to be looking at and what the upstairs show is very much of a kind of mid-career retrospective. And the Museum of Modern Art has had a long history with Orozco, beginning in 1993 when we mounted his first solo exhibition in New York, I think, in fact, his first solo exhibition in the United States. It was part of the Project Series. So those of you that come, which I'm sure most of you come to the museum frequently, know that the Project Series is a venue to showcase work by emerging or maybe unknown artists. At the time, as I said, Gabriel was, you know, not at all a very well-known artist. Typically, project exhibitions happen or take place in a single gallery space. In preparation for his exhibition, he spent months at the museum. I mean, coming here once, twice a week, and just paying attention to the way that people behaved in the museum spaces, the difference in behavior from the moment someone entered into a pristine white gallery versus the way that they behaved in the corridors or on the escalators. And after observing the way that visitors acted in this kind of institutional space, he decided to lobby to have his show take place in these in-between areas. He didn't want to show anything in a white gallery, in a place where he says people are ready to see art. Instead, he was interested in kind of creating an accident by placing his work in places that one might not expect to see it. So you'll see here, this is a sculpture from 1990 called Recaptured Nature. It's in balloon filled, a balloon made out of the inner tubes of truck tires filled with air that he placed on the second floor landing just off of the escalators. In between the escalators, he installed a long scroll. It's a work called Dial Tone that's made out of cut and pasted phone book pages. Both of these works are on view upstairs now. And then in the museum sculpture garden, you can see, if you look carefully, he hung a hammock between two trees. The work is called Hammock Hanging Between Two Skyscrapers. And the idea here was taking this rarefied space for viewing art and kind of drawing attention to the fact that it is, after all, a garden. But I think maybe the most memorable project that he did took place outside of museum property. Across the street from the museum on 54th Street is a row, it's a one building of residential building where he asked all of the occupants to place oranges in their windows. And unfortunately, the image here is not great, but you can imagine, you know, walking down the street, the kind of surprise that this would have, I think, generated in a passerby. It's not clear entirely that this is a work of art. It exists somewhere, between inside and outside of institutional space. Of course, a project like this realized on such large scale, that kind of negates the possibility of coincidence. But again, I think the interest for him here was very much, I think, in all of his work, site specificity. And when I say that, I mean that not just the way that the work of not just saying that the work of art relates specifically to one particular location, but site specificity in the way that it relates to the way that viewers will encounter it. And I think this is very true in the way that the upstairs show has been installed, though it's a little bit more conventional in that he is using the actual gallery spaces. But at the entrance to the exhibition, you'll see, you know, this is right when you come off of the escalators or step off of the the elevators, which would be somewhere over here where the pointer is. But here he's positioned in a work called Elevator from 1994. It's a sculpture he created for a one-person show in Chicago, similar to our project space, where he took an elevator, and you can see he sliced it horizontally in half, so that, and then he removed a section, so that, that now fused together, the interior height of the cabin is actually equivalent to the height of his own body. And we don't encourage, but we allow viewers to enter into the elevator upstairs. And it's a very shocking experience. I mean, it's, you really do have a, it's a claustrophobic space. As Gabrielle says, our bodies carry a memory of experiences, of past experiences. So we've all had the experience of entering into an elevator, of course, and we have a certain expectation of what that space feels like. By shrinking it in half, he alters those expectations. And it gives you the sensation that the elevator is almost simultaneously rising and falling, kind of collapsing on your body. And then behind is this wallpaper. I've had so many questions about the wallpaper. This is a blow-up of a page of a collage that's found in his notebook. So the top image here is the actual photograph of the collage as it exists in his notebook. And these artist notebooks, he has a volume of 17 of them. They're like sketchbooks. I mean, he writes, draws, creates collages. I'm just showing you an example of another page in his notebook. But he created this out of two photographs, images from that he found in a National Geographic magazine. The image in the background is a volcano exploding in the Philippines. It's Mount Pinatubo. And the little kid is actually a girl from, a Sherpa girl from the Himalayas. And this type of photography in general is not something that the artist is particularly fond of. This idea, kind of National Geographic style photography, where you're looking at the world through a tourist's eye. Just by comparison, on the bottom, I'm showing you two photographs taken by Gabrielle. So it's a very different type of image. I mean, there's none of that drama that you see up top in images such as the two below. And so by, I think, conflating or by collapsing these two images on top of one another, he's essentially negating them. I mean, there's an absurdity and an irreverence that comes out of, you know, this little girl's head emerging from this big explosion in the background. And this was a work that ended up being the cover of our catalog, and then he wanted it to use it again at the entrance to the exhibition. And this was because, again, this interest in, or I would say, sensitivity to sight. So those of you that are familiar with the upstairs floor will know that this is a really busy space. At the time that Orozco opened, there was the Bauhaus show next door. Right across the way from the elevator is the bookshop. It's a place where, I mean, there's a lot of people. It's very noisy, and he somehow wanted his art to kind of resonate, to also be loud and noisy and kind of attention-getting, so to speak. But you'll also notice that he placed the elevator, in fact, directly in front of the doors, in front of the entrance to the exhibition, creating a blockade between this space and the space inside. He didn't want people to, he wanted to create an environment in which, that separated the outside from the inside. And when you do walk into the exhibition, this is what you see. Empty shoebox. It's called Empty Shoebox. It's a work from 1993. Unlike the elevator, this is a straightforward ready-made. It's the plain old white shoebox that he positioned on the floor. And this was a risky choice, I think, beginning the exhibition this way. And I think this is very much what he had in mind. He often talks about undermining the expectations of the viewer. So after seeing, you know, a rather spectacular entrance, a spectacular large-scale sculpture at the start of the exhibition, you're kind of expecting to see something more in kind right when you walk in. And instead, what you see is that. And he has said that in placing this, he really wanted to, again, undermine viewers' expectations, but also ready them for a different type of looking. He talks about it a lot as a kind of cleansing process. So if you imagine the outside being a kind of a very loud space. Here he's turned the volume way down, asking us to follow suit, to really start thinking and start looking perhaps more carefully. And this continues, this kind of cleansing process into the first gallery space. This is a work called Yogurt Caps. It's four plain Dannon yogurt caps pinned to the center of four otherwise empty gallery walls. Again, another ready-made object. He first showed this in 1994 at Marion Goodman Gallery. And in fact, a lot of the work on view in the exhibition was made for a particular time or for a particular exhibition. One of the challenges we had was whether we were going to recreate complete installations of his work or whether we were just going to, kind of take particular objects from those installations and install them anew. This is the only time that we decided to recreate the installation. Excuse me, let me go back. And this is because I think of how significant this show was for Gabrielle. This is a view of the work in 1994 at Marion Goodman Gallery. So again, I want to just reiterate that Gabrielle was a very kind of unknown artist at the time. Marion Goodman Gallery, as you know, is a blue chip gallery on 57th Street. At that time, Goodman represented artists that were further along in their careers, typically in their 40s, 50s, 60s, European artists. And here she decided to take on Gabrielle, who at the time was in his very early 30s. He was a Mexican artist. And so if you were around and interested in contemporary art, there was, buzz in the air. This was a big deal, a big exhibition. And what he decided to do was empty the space and just place these four yogurt caps on the center of the wall. Again, this idea of undermining expectation. He said that people walked into that gallery, turned around, and walked out. It's almost like, oops, they forgot to do the show. But I think, in addition to this, maybe there's some kind of shock value or surprise value at work here, but I think that the idea behind the work is kind of more interesting than that. These mark the four cardinal points. The way that your body interacts with it in this space when you enter it, you can never see all four simultaneously when you're standing in the center. So your body, you're kind of asked to move around. So it activates the way the viewer in space. And the way that it came about is that he had eating yogurt. He had a yogurt cap lying around on the counter of his kitchen. Eventually, he pinned it to the wall of his apartment. And there it stayed for about 6 months. And he thought, well, if these are interesting enough as physical objects, or interesting enough for me to look at for 6 months, maybe someone else will also think that they're interesting. Now we have thoroughly been cleansed. The first sculpture that we see is My Hands Are My Heart. It's this little lump of clay that he made in 1992. It's not a fine art material. It's a brick clay taken from a factory that he found in a brick factory outside of Mexico City. And I think this is very typical for the type of work that he did in the 90s with regard to materials. He almost never uses fine art materials. He was a bit of a scavenger working with things that were easily accessible at hand. And what he did here was take this ball of clay and squeeze it between his two hands. You can see the corresponding photograph in the background that illustrates the way that the work was made. And this is as close as we're going to get to a self-portrait. Although I would argue that self-portraiture is an important kind of implicit theme in so much of his work. What we're looking at here again is the kind of the body presented as an absence. This is the void between his two hands. But self-portraiture, you can kind of think about it in terms of the elevator, the fact that the interior height is positioned, the interior height of the cabin is equivalent in height to his body, or even something like the yogurt caps. One thing I didn't mention is that here they're positioned equivalent to his eyes, so they become almost like lenses. And if we turn to the right, the next work is Yielding Stone. It's a ball of plasticine equivalent in weight to the artist's body. So he took plasticine, which is a modeling clay. It's a type of material that can't be fired. It's a type of material that can't harden, so it's always forever changing. After he rolled it into a ball, he actually rolled it through city streets so that you would get this patina of dirt and debris on its surface. And then position in the gallery, it always constantly changes. Every time it's exhibited, it's going to be slightly different. It, in fact, sags ever so slightly because of the gravity in the room. I mean, in the time that it's been installed, I've seen, again, subtle differences in its shape. The genesis of this work also, kind of surprisingly, links back to the Museum of Modern Art when he was here preparing for his project show. It was very kind of careful looking that he was doing, and he noticed that even in this kind of most pristine white gallery, there was always dust bunnies floating around in the crevices of the space, and he wanted a work that kind of highlighted this. But I think the importance here is this undermining our notion that sculpture is a kind of sculpture is permanent, or the very notion of sculptural permanence. I mean, this is, again, part of the, I think, interest in this work for him, and by extension for us, is that it will always, you know, forever be changing. When we enter into the main room, this is what I was alluding to a little bit earlier when I said that almost so many of his sculptures were made for particular moments. He often shows up, or especially in the 90s, would show up at an exhibition if he was invited to exhibit. He would show up with nothing and then spend time in a particular city or in a particular location, and that kind of dictated the type of work that he would make. So in this main space, we have Black Kites from 1997, La Déesse in the center in 1993, Recaptured Nature, that balloon made of inner tube tires that he showed here in 1993, Four Bicycles, There Is Always One Direction, 1994, and then some more recent paintings. But what we wanted to do is place all of these very public, I mean, these are the greatest hits, so to speak, place all of these objects together to see how they would react in relation to one another. I mean, there's no one way of talking about Gabriel's work in terms of medium. He works with pretty much, you know, as you can see, you know, all sorts of things. And so how would these things react in a room together? And I think what was so nice and surprising is all of the rhymes or visual echoes that exist between objects that materially have nothing in common. In the background here, you see these floating sculptures called spumes. They're made out of polyurethane foam, which some of you might know is a kind of insulation material. It's a liquid, very toxic liquid that you fill when you're, you know, building something, you'll fill in the cracks and it expands. And so he used that material, poured it into latex hammocks to create these fish-like shapes. But here next to La Déesse, you can see the kind of visual echoes. And I think this happens over and over in that space, in that main space. So the circles on the bicycle are echoed in the circular form of the inner tube. And then, this isn't a great image, unfortunately, I tried to show a detail, but here you have a drawing made of graphite that features the circular pattern. Again, the bicycle wheels turning, the circles in the painting, and then even that little yielding stone in the corner. I mean, this is all something that we were surprised by. We knew this existed in his work, but it wasn't really until we got the objects in that space that all these echoes came to the surface. But I will talk about some of the major sculptures that are on view in that room, beginning with La Déesse from 1993. This is a Citroën, 1960s model Citroën DS car that he sliced into three sections, removed the center section, and then welded the vehicle back together. So now it's a kind of narrower version of its former self. The car now only has a room for two people, one person in the front and one person in the back. And I think it's important here to note that Gabriel, when making sculpture, always insists that he's never creating anything new, that what he's doing instead is kind of reinterpreting things, kind of objects that already exist. And I think this is particularly true of this sculpture. The La Déesse, when it first rolled off of French assembly lines in the 1950s, was a kind of beacon of the future. It was, you know, a very aerodynamic, very sleek vehicle. And by slicing that vehicle in half, and he exaggerates those innate properties of the original design. Four Bicycles, There Is Always One Direction, is from 1994. the following year to work made out of four bicycles, as the title suggests, that are fit together. So he's removed the handlebars and the tires of the bikes and just fit the seat support of one bike into the handlebar support of another until the structure emerges. And the thing, it's not actually a welded sculpture. It's held together just by gravity and this single kickstand. He made the work in Rotterdam for an exhibition. So he showed up in Rotterdam about 2 weeks before the show opened with nothing, as I've been saying. And Rotterdam is a city that people traverse by bicycle. So he, like many of the city's residents, rented some, or maybe he bought a bike, and was just driving around for a while. And then he decided, well, if I'm making a sculpture for Rotterdam, I'm going to use this kind of emblem, this emblem of the city as my material. And people often compare Gabriel's work to say that he's kind of continuing the legacy of Marcel Duchamp. Here is Duchamp's bicycle wheel from 1913. And I think certainly that's the case, but I think a more interesting comparison in this case may be Picasso's Bull's Head from 1943. Picasso's Bull's Head is a sculpture made out of a bicycle seat and handlebars. And of course, what he's done is kind of fashion them in such a way that they become essentially more than the sum of its parts. It becomes an object that resembles a bull's head. So this is almost the inverse of the operation that Gabriel's doing here, where the bicycles are never anything more than what we see. I mean, it's four bicycles fit together to create this kind of a sculpture that I think addresses the idea of mobility without actually being able to move. And then there's Black Kites. I think the most iconic of his work, when there's a, you know, kind of history of art book that's published 50 years from now, I think this image will definitely get a whole page and probably, you know, maybe even two paragraphs in a book like that. But what it is, it's a human skull that he covered with a dense graphite grid. And I think in this case, the biography is important. He began this work in 1996 when he suffered from a collapsed lung. So his lung collapsed, he went to the hospital for about 2 weeks, and then on doctor's orders, he was no longer allowed to travel. I can't say enough how much travel was such an important part of his work in the 90s. He was literally never in one place for more than a week or 2 weeks. And here, because of this collapsed lung, he had to spend about 6 months indoors. And so he wanted to work on something that kind of made sense under those conditions. He decided to create this drawing on a skull that he purchased at Evolution, a store in Soho. You can still actually buy human skulls there. And then this was all done by hand. So this kind of gridding or mapping the topography of the bone with pencil. And I just want to show this image by Albert Durer. This is an image of a draftsman drawing a woman. What you can see in the middle here is this grid. And I think this is important to Gabriel's Black Kites. What he's interested here in is this kind of collapsing abstract geometry onto organic form. And the grid has, I think, especially in the context of art history, is this kind of hyper-rational device. When thinking about the way that the grid functions in an image like this, is that so the draftsman is looking through the grid, and then it's the human body that in fact becomes warped to accommodate the rectilinear structure of the grid to create this one-point perspectival drawing. And here it's the inverse of that. As you see, it's the grid, in fact, that bends and stretches to accommodate the contours of the skull. And I think another thing that's interesting that's happening here is this idea, his use of the ready-made. The skull is probably the furthest thing, I mean, it's a totally unique object, it's the furthest thing from a ready-made or even from the tradition of the ready-made as you can get. And he is, in fact, using the skull here as a ready-made. It's an object that he purchased, kind of interchangeable with any other skull that he would have found. And it's, of course, the drawing that is the checkerboard pattern that is painstakingly handmade. I'm sure you may have seen Matrix Mobile in the in the atrium of the museum. And the skull is kind of the grandfather of the whale. The Matrix Mobile is a sculpture that he made in 2000, a drawing sculpture that he made in 2006. It was a commission by the state of Mexico. It was a sculpture that permanently hangs in the Jose Vasconcelos Library in Mexico City. So he was commissioned to do this work. He, before the library was completed, he went inside the structure to decide what he would do, and you can see the way that there's these floating bookshelves, and in fact, the interior of the library looks a bit like a skeleton. So as soon as, upon entering the space, he decided, well, he can envision a whale skeleton hanging in that space. So he found a whale, excavated it from the sand in Baja California Sur, and then created this drawing, graphite drawing, on top of the bones. And what you're looking at, what he did was create a drawing of concentric circles based on the points of movement on the whale skeleton. And they kind of radiate outwards. So the finished work, despite the fact that the skeleton, in fact, cannot move, it kind of creates the effect or alludes to the effect of movement. And just like the skull, he didn't want the drawing to just be a random tattoo that is applied to the surface. He wanted it very much to relate to the structure of its support. But here, I mean, these are just the funny things that end up happening. If you actually stand here midway between the car and the skull, you look at the two headlights of the car staring at you, and then turn your head to the right and see the two eye sockets of the skull. So despite the fact that, again, there's very little cohesion in terms of the types of materials that he's using, there's actually quite a bit of cohesion in the ultimate forms that these objects take. But so if this is the public space, the work that most people know, what we wanted the back to be was a private space, a space that allowed you to enter into the artist's head a little bit more and shine light onto his working process. So Gabriel actually does not keep a studio. He makes all of his work on site. The materials dictate where the work will be made. So the car, La Déesse, was made, in fact, in a Peugeot garage outside of Paris. The bicycles, again, they were made in a warehouse in Rotterdam. But and for this kind of everyday life, he doesn't have the way that he works is that there is no division or separation between his life and his work. I mean, it's almost like a kitchen table type of art. He makes small maquettes at not his kitchen table, but at a little desk in a small apartment that he had when in New York on Washington Place. So the centerpiece of this room kind of addresses the way that he works. This is a sculpture called Working Tables, 2000 to 2005. And what you're looking at is a collection of leftovers, things that he, for one reason or another, never felt were complete. And he began making these working tables. There are three sets of these in public collections right now. The first set was made in 1996 when he was going, he was preparing for an exhibition at the Kunsthaus Zurich, and he didn't know what to show. And so around his apartment, he had white shoeboxes filled with all of these leftovers, prototypes for sculptures that were later made on a larger scale, sometimes not made at all. He never throws this material out. This is something that it's almost like a personal archive that he goes back to every couple of years for new ideas. And what he decided to do in 1996 was to show all of these sculptures on a large platform and consider that a completed work of art. And in talking about this work, he really hopes that viewers, and particularly, in a museum, he hopes that a lot of his viewers will be other artists, but that you come and start thinking through the way that these objects were made. And if something here is maybe undesirable or unfinished, you in your head can think of a way that it would be complete. And so in the center, we have the accumulation of objects. On the right, we have a long shelf of completed sculptures. And they're similarly scaled. A lot of the materials are the same. In fact, some of the sculptures, there are prototypes for some of the finished sculptures that you see here on this table. And I think we wanted to make a very clear distinction between these two areas. Again, these kind of unfinished leftovers versus the completed work. And when I asked him very recently, because someone asked me, you know, well, what's the difference? Why is one considered finished versus and another is not? And he said, well, that's really the question. So. And then in the background, here on the back wall, we have a work called Until You Find Another Yellow Schwalbe. It's an accumulation of 40 photographs. So you have the sense of accumulation here, echoed again on the back wall. But importantly, we knew right from the beginning when we were installing the show that this was going to go on that back wall. The space, the sixth floor space that we're occupying, is a difficult space to work with because it's a dead end. So, you know, sometimes you get to the back and think, oh, well, this is it. We wanted a work that was bright and that somehow related to the work in the to the larger sculpture in that main room, kind of bounced the viewer back out into the main space. And this is a work made in 1995 when the artist was living in Berlin. He was there on a grant. As soon as he gets to Berlin, he purchases this yellow Schwalbe motorcycle. It's a 1960s model. It was made in East Berlin, so it was this kind of relic from the past, but also a kind of cultish object. All, you know, very many young people at the time were driving around on these scooters. And as he was driving around, he would notice it was almost like a club or a community that existed. People would wave to him, people that had similar motorbikes. And so he decided that this would be his entry into getting to know Berlin. He spent, I think, a period of 6 months every day getting on his scooter and just driving around aimlessly looking for a mate, looking for a parked yellow Schwalbe that he would then park his next to the one that he found and then take the photograph. Eventually, this led to the 40 photographs that you see here. One part of the project that isn't maybe entirely obvious by looking at the images is that what he also did was leave a little pamphlet on the scooter that he found, inviting the owner to a Schwalbe convention that would take place on October 3rd in front of the Art Museum in Berlin. And October 3rd is the date that was the anniversary of the 5-year anniversary of the reunification of Germany. And so the 40th photo in the series shows the convention. Unfortunately, only two other Schwalbes came. So it talks about the, but it's a humorous, lighthearted work, but I think it does really evoke this kind of complicated, Germany's complicated history, where you are now in 1995 getting objects from where these objects from the former East German Republic have become these kind of capitalist fetishized objects. And then coming back around after being in that backspace, the idea is that you start seeing some of this large scale work anew, kind of with a deeper understanding of how it is that the artist works. And then the last room of the show is our little reading room where we showcase his painting. Now, his painting, I think, is the hardest part of his practice to kind of contextualize. When you think of Gabriel Orozco as the artist that makes sculpture with trash that he finds lying around, how do you, how do you hold these two things together? Sculpture made from dirt, from leftovers, and these pristine panels, wood panels made with tempera and gold foil. And I think, critics writing about Gabriel's work have had the hardest time dealing with this part of his production. He began painting in 2004, although he did study, when he was in art school, he studied to be a painter, but he never painted as part of his professional career. And then in 1994, he had a show at the Serpentine Gallery in London. In the months in advance of that show, he began painting, and he did this rather in secret. So when he showed up at the Serpentine with paintings in tow, the curator had, you know, no idea what to make of them. And though his practice as a painter started in 2004, it actually began much earlier than that. In his notebooks, you see these circular diagrams. I mean, they're everywhere. This is just one page, but this is from 1995. I could have shown you a page from 1991, you would have seen, again, similar diagrams. Eventually, these diagrams made their way into kind of proper Finnish titled works of art. This is 12 Korean notebook pages, also on view upstairs, where you're looking at the diagrams on little bits of notebook. And then you see them on banknotes, on airplane tickets, on scraps of paper that, again, were easily accessible. In the case of the banknotes, he always used banknotes that were rather devalued. So upstairs we have a rupee and a Polish banknote. So it was, you know, the support was, in a sense, less expensive than had he purchased new paper. And then in 2004, after a lot of trial and error, he came to this particular composition that he found to be particularly satisfying. He ran the composition through a computer program and generated 672 different possibilities. They all have the same composition. What changes from each work is the way that the color is distributed across the surface of the canvas. And it's in fact distributed according to the moves of a knight in a chess game. So two up, one to the side, or one to the side and two up. I mean, it's kind of complicated rules, but eventually what you're getting is 672 different possibilities. These are called the samurai tree invariants collectively. So we have three on view upstairs. And of those 672 possibilities, he's just slowly begun this project of turning them into paintings. So to date, there's about 120 of these in existence. And when asked, you know, why did you start painting? He insists that these paintings aren't really paintings. He considers them to be diagrams for the way that things evolve or naturally grow. So if you think of almost like tree rings where it starts from the center and grows outward, I mean, it's a very similar process that's happening here that's generating this compositional structure. He thinks of the center of the painting as the vanishing point, the kind of typical way that the center is thought of, but also as the gravity point. So you're kind of operating in a horizontal or a vertical axis when the paintings are on the wall, but also, I mean, imagine them flipped horizontally, where they become, I think, containers for action as much as they are containers for image. In fact, the heavy supports, when you look at them from the side, the heavy supports almost, the objects themselves almost look like game boards. And then downstairs, on the second floor in our prints galleries, we have a whole series of 672 prints. Actually, about 450 of them are on the wall. He did realize all of the variations as a series of prints, which the museum acquired about 2 years ago. And I think what's so striking here is the difference from when you enter this space, which really does feel like a computer-generated space, feels like a very digital space, versus looking at these handmade objects upstairs, these kind of very kind of physical works that I think call to mind icons or are somehow outdated in terms of the materials that he's using. There's also a great chasm between concept and execution, because again, though he made the painting by the first samurai tree painting by hand, the whole series was generated by a computer program. So there's a distinction between this, again, kind of computer space, digital space, and this kind of handmade execution that you see on the surface of the paintings. So I'm going to end there and see if there are any questions.
You said he used graphite on the bones and the skull. It looks like paint. What type of graphite did he use?
It's just a pencil.
Like an ebony pencil.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a regular pencil that he just, I mean, it was a very laborious process where it's, you know, it's almost like caked on. He went over it more than one time to get that kind of thick.
And then he coated with something. It was very shiny. The whole thing is shiny.
It's shiny. It's not really that shiny. I think it maybe seems shiny because of the projection and because of the way that it's lit, but it's actually not that shiny. There's a sealant on it just to keep the graphite from flaking off, but nothing more than that. And you're not getting that much reflection in the actual object when you go upstairs, outside from the graphite, which itself is, you know, slightly reflective. Minerally, yeah?
Yeah. Some of the walls, see, because I'm painting on it, you know,
yeah.
Bluish.
Like that?
Yes.
Oh, this. This is just, so if you look over there, it's not there. It's just the projector.
Oh, okay. Oh,
cool. Yeah, so that's not anything. Yeah.
How did he happen to find the whale?
As soon as he knew he wanted to make a sculpture out of a whale, he called his friend, who was the former director of the Natural History Museum in Mexico City, and said, can you help me find a whale? The guy knew where to find whales. They went to a whale, like a natural preserve, and he got permits from, because the whale is actually property, whale bones are property of Mexico City, or Mexico, excuse me. And so, so because this was a commission by the state of Mexico, then he was allowed to use the whale bone. So he excavated it from the sand. Yeah.
Is there some kind of a comprehensive definition of art that can include this and a Rembrandt portrait, for example?
I'm sure there is, but am I able to generate one for you now? Probably. I think I would need to spend some more time thinking about it. But yes. Yes, and sure.
The shoebox can be art because it's in a museum.
Well, that's a little bit of the point that I was trying to make. I don't think that the shoebox is art because it's in a museum. In fact, I think if we took that shoebox and moved it to a different part of even the exhibition, I don't think that it would function in the same way that it functions at the beginning. I mean, so here, so much it's about placement and about the way that it interacts with that space. You're looking at a kind of white space, kind of a white box within a white box. There's a nice rhyming between this little white nothing box and the big steel box outside. I mean, all of this are things that he's taking into consideration. And in fact, I mean, I think if we tried to move that box into a different part of the show, it would never function that same way, and hence maybe wouldn't be called art. Yeah.
Why do you think the skull is the image that will, you know, if you're talking about blasting? Because when I was there, that was not the one.
I think it's probably one of his, I mean, for, it's one of my favorite works, which is why. I will be writing this book that I spoke of. But I think that it's probably one of his most complicated works, and a work that, I mean, I just, you know, scratched the surface, because I could probably talk about the skull for a full hour, but all of the kind of art historical implications of using a skull, the memento mori image, go back to, again, this idea of this kind of abstract geometry and natural forms. Some people talk about, in the case of Orozco, this skull kind of following in this tradition of Mexican decorated skulls. I mean, there's this kind of wealth of reference that I think this object, more so maybe than the others, just, I mean, everything kind of coalesces in this one work. So again, and maybe I didn't give a fair or long enough explanation, but I do think that this is the kind of the sculptor, the iconic Orozco sculpture. And just this is a little bit of an addendum, but he made this work for the Documenta exhibition in 1997. It's kind of big, you know, I want to say like the Venice Biennale. The person at the time that was curating the show was a woman named Catherine David, who's a French curator, and he said he just relished the fact of giving a French curator a decapitated head to show. But so it's, you know, that wasn't part of the genesis of the work, but those types of meanings I think are, you know, in fact important, these kind of cultural, the way that this object resonates differently in different cultures. Yeah?
Is there any concern about the moral implications of using a human skull to turn into a work of art? It's one thing about a skeleton of a whale, but this was presumably at some point a human being.
Yes. I mean, that's a good question.
Did
A decade later, and I don't know if that is that. Is that a? I don't know if that's. Is that a real human skull as well?
Certainly was.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess there could be, depending on your point of view. I mean, I don't see a problem or a quandary, but I think
would you
one
want
could.
Your skull to be used at some point. It's a work of art.
I mean, it'd give me a long afterlife. No, I wouldn't mind, but.
That's one way.
Question really also the store that sells the skulls. That's it's really there.
Right, it's exactly. Right, exactly.
Well, it's the store's moral quandary, it's the artist's moral quandary, it's the museum's moral quandary, and then it's the spectator.
Right.
So I think your question points to some of what Paulina was talking about this work having so many layers of meaning, because that's why skulls and like old master paintings, they're an object to contemplate our mortality with, right? So that's one of the layers.
Right.